This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next speaker is Dr. Melissa Troster. She's at the Department of Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. Sorry, UNC. And she's also the PI of one of the Windows of Susceptibility programs here in the BCERC. So thank you, Melissa.
Sure.
Okay,
thanks. So a lot of the background that I'm about to present is actually work that's come from Pepper Shadeen and Ginger Borges' lab. So it's a pleasure to speak in this section on pregnancy and then also to precede Dr. Russo, who will present the other side of the story. So I'm going to talk about sort of the stromal side or all of that connective tissue that surrounds epithelium and how that influences our ideas about how breast cancer might be developing and also helps us to formulate hypotheses about specific windows of susceptibility. And then I'm also going to talk about a particular environmental exposure, which is obesity, and how that might be interacting with these changes that are happening in the course of the lifespan. And then I'm going to focus in a little bit on basal-like breast cancer, which is a particular subtype of breast cancer, which we think has unique associations with both pregnancy and obesity. So this is a different variation on the curves that you just saw, showing that pregnancy-associated breast cancer is something that happens in the first few years following a pregnancy. And what you see here is a line, a dashed line at 1, which shows us the risk in nulliparous women of breast cancer. And then there's a period of time before 10 years where women have an elevated risk of breast cancer following a delivery. And it takes about 7 to 10 years to cross over, and it varies depending on age. But at some point, a lifetime risk of breast cancer is reduced due to a pregnancy. The underlying explanation for why that lifetime reduction in risk occurs focuses largely on changes that happen in the epithelial cells. So those cells undergo changes that cause the cells to have very different behavior and very different morphology and appearance. And this can be readily examined in mouse tissue and also, as Dr. Borges was just showing, is also evident in human tissue, but in much greater variation in humans. So one of the things you're going to hear a lot from me today is about how humans are just much more heterogeneous and that we all behave very uniquely. And this poses a challenge for us as scientists when we're trying to develop public health messages because we have quite a bit of variation in human populations. And so it's very hard to predict individual risk. And it's also particularly hard to communicate about these issues when we have complicated messages such as pregnancy does one thing for a period of time and then another thing at a different period of time. And so in speaking with some of the advocates here today, I just wanted to encourage you to help us to think about how to best communicate these scientific concepts, which tend to be complicated, but are nonetheless, you know, fundamental to helping us develop these public health messages. So what we observe is that, going back to this figure, there's this period of elevated risk. And here, this is work from Pepper Shadeen and Dr. Borges that showed that, you know, there's this massive influx of immune cells that occurs in involuting mammary gland. And you can see there those black dots in the involuting areas, which represent macrophages. And this is a very stimulating environment. It produces a lot of different proteins and cytokines that the epithelial cells respond to by proliferating and other sorts of wound responses and migration responses, things that we think of as being bad for cancer progression. So when we look at this from a biological perspective, we take what is largely an epidemiologic set of data, and that tells us about the curves and what's happening at the population level. And what our goal is to try to probe that deeper on a biological level and start to try to understand what are the mechanisms that are driving each portion of that curve. So there might be a period at the beginning of this time after delivery where we can think of the stroma and all those immune cells and other stromal components as being dominant. And then another portion later on after a woman has given birth where the epithelium becomes dominant and is driving the major associations with risk. But there are two problems with this model that we identified as needing further research. One of those is the fact that breast cancer is not a single disease. Basal-like breast cancer is associated with increased parity. So what we see with basal-like breast cancer does not mimic this overall curve. We see that breast cancer risk goes up and stays up. The other problem is that there are a lot of things that change in a woman's life when she has a child. It's not just this stromal response, but there's lots of lifestyle factors and environmental exposures that change. And so one of the things that we've noted is that obesity increases very much in Paris women compared to nulliparous women. So here you can see average rates of obesity are about 11.3% in Paris women and only 4.5% in nulliparous women. And this also depends on race. And because African-American women are particularly susceptible to basal-like breast cancer, we think this is an important factor to research further. And I also point out that I'm from North Carolina, which is not one of the blue states on that map. We have a much higher percentage of obesity in... we're not blue in a number of different ways, but... We almost were blue, but the central hypothesis that we wanted to investigate with our research was this idea that parity in the postpartum period represent a window of susceptibility for environmental obesity, and that by studying this period, we might learn some things about pathways and environmental exposures that could be modified during that period and change a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer. So we've taken three different approaches in my research group. The first is we've been looking at basal-like microenvironments. So what we want to understand is how does a basal-like cancer cell interact with the cells around it, and how might that change its behavior? The second is that we've looked at basal-like microenvironments in specific mouse models that are designed to study this most aggressive type of breast cancer. Basal-like breast cancers are the triple-negative breast cancers that tend to have very poor survival, especially in the first few years after diagnosis. And so we're trying to study specifically what are the biological patterns that happen in a mouse model. And there we can actually manipulate diet and try to understand how high-fat diet influences breast cancer risk in the specific subtype. And then finally, we're trying to integrate all this in terms of what happens in human beings and looking at obese and postpartum microenvironments in human tissue. So I'm going to start by telling you about our in vitro studies with basal-like breast cancer cells interacting with the surrounding stroma. So here you see a cluster diagram, and what we do here is we do gene expression microarrays, which enable us to look at thousands of genes at a time. And if you look down the columns here, each column represents a separate experiment where we've basically taken epithelial cells, which are represented in blue here, and put them together with fibroblasts. And we allow these cells to get into communication and communicate back and forth via soluble factors. And then by running gene expression microarrays, we can measure how the gene expression of many different genes changes at a given point in time. And we can look at, are there specific changes that tend to occur in luminal breast cancers that don't occur in basal breast cancers and vice versa? So what you see here is what we call a heat map. And on the right-hand side at the top is this dendrogram that tells you how related the different samples are. So you see cell lines like MCF7, ZR75, and T47D. Those are luminal breast cancers. They're ER positive. They tend to be your better prognosis breast cancers. And they have a very distinct pattern of interaction with their surrounding stroma. The cells on the left in the hot colors are the basal-like breast cancers, and they have a very distinct pattern. And the pattern that seems to be more common in basal-like breast cancers are a lot of pro-inflammatory genes, cytokines and things like that, that help cells to become more migratory. So what we did then after finding this in vitro is we asked the question, well, if this is true in a single model system, in a cell culture system, it should be observable in tumors. So we wanted to link it back to in vivo. And the interesting thing that we found is that here you can see a test set of human samples, and the blue samples are luminal breast cancers, and the red samples are basal-like breast cancers. And PAM50 is our gold standard method of distinguishing these two. So the gold standard result as to which type these tumors are is shown in that first line. In the second line, we took a gene signature that came from the cellular communication state of these cells. So we basically looked at how they were talking to one another, and we used that to classify the cells as either being luminal or basal. And we did pretty well. But what was most interesting is that just looking at the fibroblast component alone, not even looking at what the epithelial cells are making, we can really highly accurately predict whether there is a basal-like or a luminal breast cancer in the presence of that fibroblast. So those responses seem very stereotyped. And this is interesting because in the past, we've tended to primarily focus on epithelial cells when we want to understand breast tumor behavior. Epithelial cells are the most abundant cell. They're the cell that undergoes the mutation. But they're not in a vacuum. So there's a lot of interesting things that can be learned by studying that surrounding tissue. And that surrounding tissue has a very basal-like specific specific response. So using a similar cell line model as Dr. Borges had mentioned, where we looked at ductal carcinoma in situ models, we wanted to look at when do these cells start to acquire this phenotype. So we compared normal MCF10A cells, which were cells that came from a woman who just had a fibrocystic disease. She'd had a biopsy for her lesion, which turned out to be benign. So those were developed into a cell line and passaged over time until they eventually formed a cell type that has the same genetics background but can form an atypical hyperplasia. So it's beginning to get a little bit stranger. And then ultimately, this cell line was passaged long enough that it became capable of forming a ductal carcinoma in situ. And so we compared how does this cell type differentially interact with fibroblasts. And what you can see here is that depending on how progressed, how far along in the etiologic process these cells have moved, they have very different patterns of expression. You can see different sort of regions of color in each of these columns. So we looked at our basal-like score that we had developed previously, and here on the right you see a curve which shows you that the MCF7, which is the luminal cell, has a negative interaction score. So it's having none of this character that we see as being this basal-like character. The SUM149 is a clearly basal-like line, and it has a high degree of this basal-like character. In the premalignant lines, what you see is that they start out as having very low basal-like character, but as soon as they get to that DCIS stage, you see an increase in the expression of that character so that they start to really look like invasive cell lines. So this is showing us that early in the process of progression, these cells start to change their interactions with the surrounding tissue. So we were interested in what were the exact mediators of this. It's interesting to see this on a gene expression pattern basis, but we want to know exactly what are the signals that are being received here. So we performed some protein assays where we basically looked at the proteins that these cells were secreting into the media. And what you see here is cytokine array data where you notice that there's one bar that's really sticking up, and this is hepatocyte growth factor. And hepatocytes are cells in the liver, and in the 80s it was discovered that the hepatocyte growth factor was a really important mediator in liver growth. But the role in breast cancer has emerged more slowly over time, and there's quite a bit of literature, actually, that hepatocyte growth factor is important in breast development as well, despite the name. So what we see here is that hepatocyte growth factor expression is very high in these ductal carcinoma in situ cells, and that when you look at the receptor, the site on the epithelial cells that detects that HGF, it is highly expressed in the DCIS cells, but not in the atypical hyperplasia or in the normal cells. So it seems like you have to have both. You have to have both the cytokine and its receptor to get the biological activity. And it looks like you don't get both until the DCIS stage in this model system. And this was true both on the RNA level and on the protein level. So we always like to see evidence of both changing in order to know that the RNA changes are really manifest as function. So then to try to link that with some kind of cell-based phenotype or something that was happening beyond the signaling level, we looked at morphogenesis assays. So the way that the breast forms in the body is it's actually very interesting. The breast doesn't make just as many cells as it needs. It makes more cells than it needs, and then it kills off the cells in the middle. So when you think about the breast cells as being a balloon, what happens is the breast kind of fills up that whole balloon totally with cells. And then the cells in the middle sort of undergo a cell death process to leave just cells lining the outsides of the duct. And that's the normal process of morphogenesis. And that's what we're measuring here in a 3D assay. And so what we looked at was how far progressed in this process of morphogenesis were these different cell lines. And you can see in the left panel here that when there's no lumen, this is here, looking at this part, there's no lumen. You see more of the normal cells, the MCF10A cells that have no lumen. And then in the DCIS, there's fewer that have no lumen because they've progressed to this side of the curve where they're actually more progressed. And this is often used as a marker of invasive potential. What this tells us is that these cells are undergoing proliferation, motility, all sorts of different changes that make them capable of being invasive and capable of forming the ductal structures that make up the breast. After finding this HGF factor was important, and that what we were able to do was then treat the cells with this antibody to HGF, essentially pulling it out of the media, and we were able to revert the phenotype. So we were able to take a cell that was more DCIS-like or showing more of that basal-like character of being morphogenically advanced and push it back towards a more normal state. So we were very excited about that. And we also wanted to know, well, if this is really important in basal-like breast cancer, it shouldn't just be in the premalignant cells, it should also be in the tumors. So we took a large database of breast tumors, and we looked at whether HGF-related changes were being expressed. And what you can see here is about 90% of these basal-like tumors have high levels of HGF expression and express a whole pattern of genes that's associated with expression of HGF, whereas only a few luminals, only about 20 to 25% of luminals have this. So it's a very strong marker of breast cancer subtype. And in an emerging line of research, we're also finding that HGF is regulating important biological characteristics of the cancers. Specifically, the cancer cells need to fuel their growth somehow, and the way they do that is by absorbing glucose. And GLUT1 is the major transporter on the cell. It's one of the major transporters on the surface of the cell that imports glucose and brings it in. And what we see here is that in all of these cell lines, at the top you see GLUT1, and this is a Western blot that measures this protein, which kind of runs as a smear because there's lots of glycosylation, so it tends to run as a smear. But what you can see is when you grow these basal-like cells with the fibroblasts, they spike their HGF, and then they spike this GLUT1 receptor. And we can reverse that glucose transporter expression by adding this HGF. So the possibility is that anti-HGF inhibitors, and there's a number of receptor antagonists that can block HGF signaling, could actually cut these cells off from their fuel supply and make it harder for them to continue to fuel their proliferation and their motility. So these are interesting findings, but they're all in vitro and they're with cell lines, and so we think it's important to have multiple different approaches to try to understand the problem from different perspectives. So my collaborator Liza Makowski at UNC has been working on basal-like microenvironments in mice using this special model called the C3 tag. And here's a picture of what happens to tumor latency. So this is the amount of time it takes for a tumor to develop. So when the mice are on regular diet, 10% fat, they have about a 19-week latency. But when you put them on a higher fat diet, the amount of time it takes for them to get a tumor is decreased. So these mice on the higher fat diet get tumors about 2 weeks earlier. So this is a suggestion that this high-fat diet is playing a role in the etiology of the disease. What we don't know is whether these animals have to get obese or if it's just the diet alone that does that for them. And that's something that we're working with some of the Michigan State researchers to try to investigate more fully. But at this point in time, what we do know is that there's a change when you have high-fat diet in the presence of obesity. Interestingly, a corresponding change happens in HGF. So this gene that I was telling you about that we found in the basal-like microenvironments goes up as you have increasing levels of fat in the diet. So at a 60% diet, we have high levels of HGF expression. Here we're looking at where it's expressed in the tissue, and you can see that HGF is expressed more highly in the 60% diet, and it's coming from the stroma, and that the receptor for HGF, c-MET, is being expressed in the epithelium, and again, it's highest in that 60% diet. So we're looking at a pathway that's subtype-specific and that appears to be modulated by an environmental factor, which is a high-fat diet in the presence of obesity. Okay, so all of that is interesting, again, model systems. And ultimately, we want to understand more about human breast cancer. So I told you I was going to talk about some of the variation we see in humans. And what we've been studying with human tissue is how obesity and parity affect the tissue itself. This is a picture from a Purio scanning where we have a 50-year-old African-American woman. This is histology of her breast tissue. There's some details here about the type of cancer she had, but this is a low BMI woman. And what you see is that the tissue is mostly stroma and adipose, but there's 7% epithelium. It doesn't sound like very much. That's actually pretty average for the human population, about 5 to 10% epithelial content. But what's striking is when I go from this picture to this picture, you can see that this is a very different looking breast tissue. This is an older woman, and the epithelium has almost all but disappeared. There's a lot less fat, and it's a very stromal-rich tissue. And this is some of the types of variation that we see in the human population. We see very distinct differences in the stromal composition, and we think that this might be important and that this might tell us something about who's at risk for breast cancer. So what we're thinking about in these models is trying to understand composition and try to put it within a context of a window of susceptibility. So we talked about this idea that there's this window of susceptibility following pregnancy, and this shows this life course approach, that early in life you get immune cell infiltration as your body develops breast tissue. And then later in life, after a pregnancy, there's another influx period where there's lots of immune cells coming in, and then they hopefully would go back down again. And this has been supported by the work from Dr. Borges' lab. But what we wanted to know was, how well does that stromal signature of immune response resolve? So you've seen some evidence that the epithelial tissue really resolves. But we're looking here at people regardless of the length of time since pregnancy. So we did gene expression signatures to compare Paris and nulliparous women. And you can see that there's a very distinct gene expression profile from Paris and nulliparous, but that human beings are not quite so orderly, and we get all sorts of misclassification here. So we tend to have nulliparous people that look like Paris people and Paris people that look like nulliparous, and this is important because it helps us to understand why people are so unpredictable. We have a very hard time predicting who is going to get a response from a particular risk factor. So this is our data showing obesity also produces similar changes. So we see lots of immune changes that occur when a woman is obese versus non-obese. And all of these point to specific pathways relating to macrophages. So I told you that macrophages are important in the period following pregnancy. We also see that obesity causes an increase in macrophage content in obese tissue. So here you see macrophage counts greater than 5 were higher in obese compared to non-obese, and that inflammation loci or crown-like structures were also high in obesity. So this has caused us to sort of think about another model. In addition to thinking about that stromal change that occurs during the postpartum period, we think that obesity might cause us either a sustained infiltration or a higher magnitude infiltration. So we're trying to use that windows of susceptibility context, but then figure out how might an environmental exposure like obesity alter that window and create either a longer window or a window that has a different character in some way. So all these three different types of approaches are helping us to get a picture on some of the mechanisms and some of the ways in which basal-like breast cancer might be influenced by the presence of high-fat diet and obesity. And as we're going through this work, I wanted to acknowledge the importance of our collaboration with our community partners, Nisha Graves and Kathleen Gray, who both have, you know, really helped us to clarify our messages and have done a lot to help us understand how to communicate these complicated concepts, and who are helping us to develop communication tools. There are also a number of collaborators at other institutions who have donated tissue for our studies and who have been extremely helpful, and I especially wanted to acknowledge NIEHS and NCI for the funding support, and also support from Avon Foundation for our work. And these are the people who've done a lot of the work in the lab as well, so thank you.
So our next speaker is Dr. Russo. I'm sure you realize all our speakers have very distinct and distinguished careers, but I'm keeping our introductions short so we can hear from them. He's a professor and director of the Breast Cancer Research Lab at the Fox Chase Center, and also adjunct professor of pathology and cell biology at Jefferson Medical School in Philadelphia. He was the director of one of our first research sites and is now a co-PI in one of the windows of susceptibilities. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the introduction, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here among all of you. This diagram represents the lifespan of the rat and also in the human, and also depicts certain areas that describe the window of susceptibility, a concept that we developed and published in 1975. And you see here in the rat that there is a red area that is the highest susceptibility window. That is when the animal are going from 35 to 55, 60 days of age. That in human, of course, they have a different concept that will be between 12 years of age to 24. And the thing that we found is that this area in the animal is when the animal is highly susceptible to develop breast cancer, especially in the rat when it's inoculated either with DMBA or methylnitrosuria. But also this is interesting to observe that the When the animal gets older, the susceptibility decreases. This is the pink line over here. And then another important element that if you induce pregnancy in the area of high susceptibility, that is the green area, the animal don't develop breast cancer, and this protection that is conferring the animal for one pregnancy and one lactation stay forever in the lifespan of the animal. And also there is a yellow area that is the prenatal period of the animal, that when the animal is exposed to different environmental agents also changes susceptibility to develop carcinoma. And the interesting part is that the same kind of pattern that we see in the animal, we see in human, that there is a window of susceptibility during the around the pubertal area that have been demonstrated by the work of McGregor when he showed that girls that were between 10 to 14, even 19 years of age, they were under the atomic bombing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are the ones that developed later on more breast cancer. And this is the reason why this specific area is important in our study. But when a woman has an early pregnancy, before 24 years of age, they are conferred a full protection that lasts for life. That is very important. And I will concentrate only in this specific area in the lifespan of the woman in which a woman has an early full-term pregnancy. Now, and this is very well demonstrated in the literature and have been also alluded by the previous speaker. The early parity, first child born from early teens to middle and 20s, have a significant protective effect. Breastfeeding, multiparity in early part of women, and each additional birth confer greater protection. Therefore, the question that we need to ask ourselves is, why pregnancy produces protection against breast cancer? And everything started in 1972 in our life. We were doing an experiment in the rat in which we are inducing pregnancy and then giving to the animal a carcinogenic agent. And Irma came to me and said, listen, we see here in the mammary gland of this animal something strange. In the nullipar women, we see this kind of terminal embattled structure. But when the animal has gone through pregnancy and lactation, we never see this terminal embattled structure. We observe a structure like this one that are lobular one. And that was a very important observation because it indicated that during the process of protection, you eliminate the terminal embed and produce some kind of permanent refractoriness to carcinogenesis. And the important thing that we demonstrate from there is that even after pregnancy and lactation is over, the animal involute, but they never go back to the terminal embed structure in the rat. They never go back to the terminal embed structure in the older animals. Now, this observation really put us in another kind of mood. What happened in human? How to study that in human? And in human, the situation is completely different. We have not only a laminar mammary gland, but a three-dimensional structures. And then the thing that we got a grant from the NCI for 5 years to study how the different structures in the mammary gland look in a three-dimensional configuration and how really they evolve during the period of life of a woman. And we get a meat slicer and start cutting 300 full breasts that were obtained from different means. And those breasts were defatted, and we were cut it, and we stained it with toluidine blue. You see here mounted in a slide, and then mounted here in a glass, in a plastic bag. And those structures show clearly the fibrous tissue containing the lobular structures of the mammary gland. And the thing that we found is that during the period that we studied from breast tissue obtained from 14 years of age, that is the earliest tissue that we got, until 64 years of age, we observed that the mammary gland will go through the process of differentiation that goes from the terminal structure that we found in the early ages, then this structure developed to alveolar bud, and from the alveolar bud that developed the lobular type 1, that is the typical terminal ductal lobular structure that was described by the old anatomist many years in 1930, and from the lobular type 1, when the woman starts getting the menstrual cycle, they develop lobular type 2, and then when the woman gets pregnant, they develop the lobular type 3. And you see here that is a very clear difference between the terminal ductal structure of the lobulus type 1 to the lobulus type 2 and 3. The lobulus type 3 is the more differentiated structure that even acquires more differentiation during lactation, and then we call lobulus type 4. But the interesting part is that when we put these structures in the lifespan of a woman, we found that the lobulus type 1 were very low, very high in the animals, in the women that are the very young women. And then when they go and get pregnant, when we see the parity history of these women, we found that the lobulus type 1 decreased, and then they start increasing the lobulus type 3. And the lobulus type 3 remain very high until the third, fourth decade of life, and they start decreasing in blue line. And then they disappear at menopause when the woman gets 50, 55, or 64 years of age. The lobulus type 3 have practically disappeared, and the only structure that really remains is the lobulus type 1, meaning that the woman differentiates the structure from lobulus type 1 to lobulus type 2, 3, and 4 during the process of pregnancy. Instead, we found that the nulliparous women, they never get this process of differentiation. Most of these nulliparous women have only lobulus type 1 and lobulus type 2, but they never get lobulus type 3. Occasionally, we saw some lobulus type 3 in the nulliparous women. That allows us to conclude that during the nulliparous women, they go from lobulus type 1 to lobulus type 2, rarely to lobulus type 3, and they, in the involution, they go back to lobulus type 1. Instead, in the parous women, they go from lobulus type 1 2, 3, 4 in lactation, and then start regression, both lactation and regression, and then still until the 3rd or 4th decade of life, you see in these women lobulus type 3 and lobulus type 2, and then in menopause, you see only lobulus type 1. Meaning that this pivotal observation that was published in 1992, almost 20 years ago, demonstrated that nulliparous and parous women have a different developmental pattern of development, that the nulliparous women never go through the process of differentiation, where the parous women go through the process of differentiation, and then at menopause, they look exactly the same one that nulliparous, but they are refractory to carcinogenesis. Therefore, that was our main question that we posed to ourselves, and our working hypothesis was the following. The breast of parous postmenopausal women exhibit a specific genomic signature that has been induced by a full-term pregnancy during the hormonal protection window, meaning that this event that takes place when the woman was young, that really produces some kind of marker, a fingerprint, or a signature that remains in the postmenopausal women. The same effect doesn't occur in the nulliparous women because they have been ongoing through the process of differentiation. And this genomic signature controls cell differentiation that lead to breast cancer prevention. Now, how to demonstrate this in human was not an easy task, because collecting normal tissue from women is difficult. And was a period in we got the collaboration with Dr. Paolo Toniolo, that he have a cohort of women in Sweden, and we made a consortium between the university, a New York University, in which Paolo Toniolo was directing that part of the study, and people in Sweden from the University of Umeå and Foxe Cancer Center. And we were able to obtain volunteer residents of Luleå, Sweden, this area of Sweden, and we performed the first study that lasted from 2008 to 2010, studying postmenopausal women aged 50 to 69. Years of age. The data of this result have been published in Cancer Prevention Research in 2011 and Medical Genomics in 2012. Now, and we are already ongoing to another study that is studying premenopausal women, in which we really want to see if the same pattern that we observe in the postmenopausal hold in this group of women. But the important thing that we found here is that we obtained from these women, postmenopausal women, core biopsy, find a needle core biopsy, and that allow us to obtain really is a approximate cylinder of 1 centimeter per 1.5 millimeter in diameter that allow to have the lobular structure, specifically lobulus type 1, with the surrounding stroma and adipose tissue. And that is the way that look the core biopsy. And from those core biopsy, we separate the RNA and we made affymetric studies. And what we found? We found that when we put all the data together, the Parus women are the ones to your left, to your right, in which they find that there are significantly upregulated genes in red, and in the newly Parus women, we found that in green, all the downregulated genes. And in the lower portion, you see the unregulated, the downregulated genes in the Parus that are upregulated in the newly Parus. Meaning that we found a signature in those women that were related to the expression of specific gene control RNA metabolisms and RNA splicing. And among the downregulated genes, the most important one was the insulin growth factor 1. Now, this allows us to go to the second question. Why certain women that have an early full-term pregnancy still develop breast cancer? And are the Parus women with breast cancer different from those that do not develop breast cancer? And this data has been published a little earlier in 2008 in Cancer Epidemiology and Biomarker. And the thing that we have done is a case control study in which we took women that were newly Parus and Parus with breast cancer and newly Parus and Parus without breast cancer. And we studied the normal tissue of this material. And what we found? We found that when we compare the genomic profile of the newly Parus without cancer, we are very similar to the newly Parus with cancer. And when we compare this with the Parus with cancer, we are very similar. But when we compare with the Parus without cancer, we are different. There was around 200 genes that were significantly different between these two groups, that are more or less the same number of genes that we identify in the study that we performed with the people in Lulea using postmenopausal women. Meaning that we conclude from this that the first full-term pregnancy induces a specific genomic signature that can be detected in the postmenopausal breast. And an event that took place in this moment in the lifespan of a woman, in the time that also is a high window of susceptibility, because we know by epidemiological study that that area, when it's affected by a carcinogenic agent, that women develop more breast cancer, when a first pregnancy takes place, a full-term pregnancy takes place, that protection conferred lasts for the whole lifespan of that woman, and we found that these women contain a specific genomic signature. Now, the next question is, what is the meaning of the genomic signature of pregnancy? How does the genomic signature of pregnancy work? And as I just indicated to you, most of the Parus women contain upregulation of genes that are related to the RNA metabolisms and RNA splicing. And everybody knows in this audience what RNA splicing. But basically is when the RNA is synthesized, a different portion of the RNA are cut and put together in order to determine the final RNA messenger that will produce the protein, a specific protein. And all the genes that are controlling this process are significantly upregulated in the Parus women. And the most important element that we identify is that most of these genes are identified in a specific compartment of the nucleus, that is the speckle. And the speckle also have a specific marker that is the CCNL2, that is a cyclin that when we perform immunocytochemistry, we found that highly bright in the Parus epithelium. Meaning that women that have an early full-term pregnancy contain a significant upregulation of the splicing mechanism that really produce this specific difference between these two groups. And the biological importance of the differential expression of genes that regulate the splicing is because that provides some kind of a security system. It's like to have a security system in the door of your house, another security system inside of your house that doesn't allow any intruder to come. Meaning that the fact that you can control the splicing mechanism will allow the cell to produce better protein and that no anomaly or no mutated protein is formed. This is an area that we are currently studying in order to understand a little better this. But it was published in Medical Genomics. But another interesting thing that we observe is that when you observe the breast epithelium of the postmenopausal women that have been, that are newly Parus, and when you compare that with the Parus women contain nuclei that are more heterochromatic than the one that you see in the newly Parus women. I don't know if I can show to you, but it's clearly seen here that they, in the nuripar women, they have a more round, more clear nuclei with less chromatin. That's called euchromatin. And when you see there in the middle, in the parus, you see that the nuclei of these cells are more smaller, more dense, and contain more dense chromatin. And also in the lower panel, in order to show that the basal cells that are positive for keratin 5 and 6 and the myoepithelial cells are not involved in this process. Only the epithelial component, the luminal cell component, are the ones that are involved in this process. Meaning that what we observe here is that during the process of pregnancy and lactation obtained during the first early full-term pregnancy in the postmenopausal women, we observe that there is a significant increase in the number of cells that are heterochromatic, meaning that there are condensation of the chromatin, meaning that has been the phenomenon that is going through that terminology is some kind of a reorganization of the chromatin. And we observe in the part of women decrease in the number of euchromatic cells. Now, the meaning of chromatin condensation indicates that the limit, the ability of the RNA polymerase II transcription complex to access DNA resulting in reduced messenger RNA protein output, meaning that what that basically means is that it's a silence of the genome in order that the cell don't produce a specific protein. And we demonstrated that because when you reacted the nuliparous and parous breast tissue with a histone 3 methylated lysine 9, there is a significant increase in reactivity and in the number of cell positive in the parous versus the nuliparous. And the same thing happened with lysine 27. In the upper panel is the nuliparous breast, in the lower panel, the parous breast, and you see that it's a significant intensity in the reaction. Now, this allows us to postulate that what happened during the parity is that have been changing the number of heterochromatic cells due to methylation of the histones. Now, when we start looking again the gene that has been identified, we identify other genes that also have been regulating the parity. And most of these genes resulted to be long non-coding regions like XIT, MALAT1, and NIT1 that are summarized in this slide. And you see that in the lower portion, there are three long non-coding regions like XIT, NIT1, and MALAT1 that are upregulated, significantly regulating the part of women that are not in the newly part of women, together with other like SH22 that is enhancer of sexta or more that belong to the polycomb, and also other chromatin binding protein like the CBX3 and CHD22. And in the nuliparous, instead, we found that there are the SOC6 and SOC17 that are down-regulating in the parous are up-regulating the nuliparous women. And you hold a minute, I try to explain this much better. Meaning that we found that long non-coding regions that are associated with the process of methylation because they, long non-coding regions, associate with some methyl transferase among them the SH2, and then allow the methylation of the histona or the methylation of certain specific genes, meaning that the polycomb group that is, together with the long coding region, is inhibiting the expression of specific genes is expressed in this cell by the ESH2, and together with the long non-coding region produce a binding that really produces some kind of repression of the expression of specific protein in this. In the trithorax that is facilitating the together with the non-coding the transcription is not expressed in the parous or nuliparous women. And XIT is a very important long non-coding region that is upregulated in the nuliparous women and is maintained upregulated because this is in association with SOC6 and SOC17. And instead, in the parous breast, XIT is significantly upregulated and we lost the other two repressors like SOC6 and SOC17. The binding of the long non-coding region to the polymerase II and the association with the ESH2 that is member of the polycomb produce this kind of picture, in which there is methylation of all these portions of the chromatin that produce the heterochromatin pattern that you see here in the parous women. Now, meaning that what we observe here, that is a significant downregulation of specific genes and upregulation of other genes, and among them is the gene that are controlling the silencing of the chromatin through the polycomb system. Now, how to induce genomic signature without full-term pregnancy? And we found that ACG is one of the first hormones that is produced in the embryo, in the placenta, and there is in literature demonstration that the ACG of chorionic gonadotropin is significantly regulated in women that have late breast cancer, and that is done by Toniolo's group. Now, when we use this model, that is the DMD-induced mammary tumors, and we treat the animal with different hormones, like progesterone and estrogens and well ACG, we found that ACG produced a significant protection against mammary carcinogenesis. And you see here in the column in white, a 100 international unit given to the animal for 21 days produced significant protection. But also we observed that when we take 10F cells that were developed in our laboratory when we were in the Michigan Cancer Foundation, that when you put in collagen, produce a normal ductal structure. When you treat with the ACG, they produce significant number of branching and secondary and tertiary branching, meaning differentiation. And when you react this cell with lysine 4, they are very active in the control and is very downregulated in the ACG treated, and is a regulation to lysine 27. And we observe that, demonstrating that XIT is also regulated by the ACG, and SH2 is also regulated by that, demonstrating that with the same phenomena that we are observing in vivo in the part of women, we can induce an in vitro system producing some kind of transcription and activation. I will call them in it. Yeah. Now, we believe that we can develop a personalized genomic signature, and this is an intermediate endpoint for evaluating the degree of mammary gland differentiation, and we can determine which woman parities have been protected. And this is very important, because up to now, all the preventive strategies that exist, like tamoxifen or raloxifen, you need to give 50 women the treatment in order that one of them respond. Now we know which woman the parity is protective because they have developed a specific genomic signature. And also, this could be a biomarker for evaluating other preventive agents. Meaning that the puberty is the high susceptibility window that we found in animals, in the rat specifically, we didn't study the mouse, and in human. But when you induce pregnancy in this specific window, you produce protection. And we are going, what is the next step that we have in our mind? I think that in working in collaboration with the Toniolo's group and the people in Sweden, we would like to transform the breast genomic signature to a blood signature of prevention. We also would like to simplify the hormonal treatment with ACG by using a small peptide, that we are doing that with a grant from the Komen Foundation, and to target the preventive strategies in young women during the window susceptibility, meaning that this peptide can be administered very easily by nasal spray or other means in order to produce the signature that we already know that is preventive. And the take-home message for all of you is that there is a window susceptibility that allows a biological intervention. And early full-term pregnancy elicits the specific genomic signature of prevention, and this genomic signature can be manipulated exogenous by using a specific hormone that can control the molecular mechanisms that I have indicated previously. And I would like to thank all my team. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We do have to get on, so we have a lot of interesting posters later, and that will be on the fourth floor. But Janice Barlow will start off our discussion. Janice is the director of Zero Breast Cancer, and she's the lead of our community outreach translation corps here in San Francisco.
Well, this is the first time I've been a respondent or discussant. But I'm delighted to, I'm not quite sure what that role is, but I'm delighted to be able to speak this afternoon, and I want to let you know that I'm a proud graduate of a two-hour improv class that was held yesterday that many of the people in the audience participated in, and one of the tips was, if you want to gauge the audience, is that you pick out two people in the audience and fixate on those two people. And they should be head nodders. So you want somebody who nods yes all the time, you know, like you're saying something really important, and then somebody who's nodding off. So when I've been sitting up here, I have designated my two people. So I can now proceed. Well, I have been very honored to have been part of the Breast Cancer and Environment Research Center since 2003. And during the first 7 years, it focused on mostly on, you know, onset of puberty as a window of susceptibility. And so I was absolutely delighted to when the programs were expanded, and that as part of this program, we were adding, you know, a session on pregnancy-associated breast cancer. And while I was in the puberty, you know, meetings, often Dr. Biro would say that 85% of women can identify their age of menarche, which is a risk factor for breast cancer, within 6 months of the actual time. So without looking at the research, I would suggest that most women who have had a full-time pregnancy can identify 100% of the time the date of their delivery and their number of children. And I don't think there's anyone here in the audience would argue that pregnancy is a time when there are tremendous changes and growth and also differentiation that occurs, and that it truly, you know, is a window of susceptibility, not only for just breast cancer, but for a lot of women's health issues. And just to kind of go through, you know, briefly, some of the just amazing things that happen, you know, one is that circulation doubles, cardiac output, you know, the heart doubles, blood sugar goes up, cholesterol goes up, fat, you know, fat is stored, fat, whatever, cells that store fat increase. And of course, it's also a time, you know, when women, lots of women, it's the first time they've really gained significant amounts of weight within a short period of time. So all of these things, as Melissa pointed out, kind of interact with, you know, breast cancer risk in the end. And then, of course, you know, women are exposed to like a sea of hormones during this period of time, both progesterones and estrones, and many different kinds of estrogens, some that, you know, non-pregnant women are exposed to. So I'm sad to admit that really after being in this field as an advocate for, you know, 15 odd years, you know, what I always thought about was breast cancer. I did know that having a first full-term pregnancy at a young age, you know, confers, you know, lowers your future risk for breast cancer, is protective of breast cancer. Of course, that age changes a lot. You know, sometimes it's over 31, sometimes it's over 30, sometimes it's 24, which is sometimes confusing. But I did know that, and I didn't, you know several theories. I know researchers have been studying, and particularly Jose Russo, for many, many years to kind of explain why there is a protective component to having a full-term pregnancy at a young age. And as Dr. Russo's, you know, research has shown, that pregnancy results in a differentiation of the breast, you know, reducing its susceptibility to carcinogens. And today when he presented, you know, I kind of talked to him briefly yesterday, you know, he's kind of drilling down on that, I don't know if you call it a hypothesis or that theory, and today, you know, presented, you know, research identifying, you know, what differentiated associations, associated molecular changes, or the genetic signature, how those persist over the lifetime, you know, until menopause. What I was really not very familiar with until I, you know, heard at another conference actually these same people speak, was that there is also, you know, a significant short-term risk for breast cancer that is pregnancy, you know, pregnancy associated. And I had, you know, heard or read in the paper, you know, obituaries, you know, of women who had delivered and had pregnancy-associated breast cancer and died, you know, when their infants were 8 months or 10 months. And I always kind of thought it was a very, very rare thing. And also I always kind of felt, you know, that there was, you know, just, you know, maybe a year or two when women were at risk. So this is, you know, a concern in some ways to me, and I'm sure to other women. So I'm not sure, as Melissa said, how you convey that, you know, that message, that public health message, in a way that isn't frightening to pregnant women. I have 2 minutes. Okay. So I guess my other comments are, you know, I think clearly, and I think what Dr. Troster added was, you know, the knowledge of looking at breast cancer risk in pregnancy-associated breast cancer by specific subtypes, which is something that the advocate community is very interested in, and also the role of environmental factors, so not just endogenous, but also some exogenous factors that might affect breast cancer tissue. So I think there's a need for continued research on identifying clinical events during pregnancy that confer risk protection in order to better understand the mechanisms, or perhaps eventually design a preventive approach for women. Clearly, we need increased knowledge of which young mothers are at risk for postpartum pregnancy-associated breast cancer, which seems to be a continual problem in breast cancer. We have difficulty predicting who's going to go from DCIS to invasive breast cancer, and what women are going to go from invasive breast cancer to metastasized breast cancer. So that's an important area. And then in talking to Dr. Troster and Nisha Graves, they pointed out that this pregnancy, this window of susceptibility, is an ideal time to communicate public health messages and health education messages, because most pregnant women, this is a period of time when they do readily and eagerly alter their lifestyles and are very eager to know, you know, what they can do to ensure a very healthy outcome for their children. And it's also a time where, you know, they also begin looking more at their health because they want to be there when their children grow up. So, and also during, Nisha pointed out, during postpartum breastfeeding sessions, you know, that's another really ideal time, I think, to deliver, you know, breast cancer prevention health messages. So thank you very much. And I think so if you have questions, I'm sure people have lots of questions. It's a very interesting session.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.